Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, who is a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and the environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Happy to be here, Ian.
And Wednesday in Detroit, the federal bankruptcy judge halted the trial and ordered the city to renegotiate this proposed settlement with its creditors. And apparently the judge was disturbed at the imbalance where Detroit's agreed to pay the banks who got them into these complicated swaps, etc. They were about to pay the bank 75 to 82 cents on the dollar, while at the back of the line, they're offering 16 cents on the dollar to the city's pensioners. So that's a pretty outrageous disparity, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say so. I had the opportunity to actually be outside the courtroom yesterday in Detroit. So I was watching things unfold. In fact, what occurred was The judge has been suggested in court that these payments to the banks, which are secured by some tax revenues of the city, should be subject to equitable subordination, meaning falling back in the line with regular creditors because of various things, including fairness issues, the so-called clean hands doctrine. And the judge has, what the judge said was, please, city, it's really the emergency manager appointed by the governor to take over the city. Tell me what your thoughts are about whether these swap obligations, derivatives obligations are enforceable. And as it turns out, the agreement they signed with the banks said that the emergency manager would agree not to challenge the swaps in court, which is kind of an interesting outcome. So what happened was that the judge said, I can't really proceed unless somebody can tell me whether these things are fair or unfair, whether equitable subordination might apply or not. And so he said, renegotiate if you want, but unless you can tell me something further, I can't enforce these things.
So how did they get into this situation? And that, of course, is you deal with, Wallace Turberville, in your new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. But for the benefit of our audience, it does seem that when you have a mayor like Kwame Kilpatrick, who is running the city, and he's now in jail, and it seems to me that the person in the city government that made all of these complicated loan deals with these Wall Street banks, with all these swaps, etc., I understand that he ends up working for the same banks that he made the deal with, and they've paid out $300 million so far and another $300 million in the pipeline. And it seems to me that you can make the case here, surely, that the U.S. attorney should step in here. I mean, is there criminality here?
Well, I can't say. I can't say that you've recited the facts correctly. So right now, what I've been advising, and I will be asked to speak to the court as an expert witness, but what I've been advising and talking about is that these things need to be looked at. I can't say, I don't have the facility or the authority to get to the heart of the matter to find out whether it was simply imprudence or whether there was something worse going on or whether there's some secret reason that these things did go on at the time. But I would be satisfied at the outset to just have the court look into it, which is what the court was trying to do, of course. And the court was frustrated because the city, in the form of the emergency manager and his advisors, would not comment on it because they felt constrained not to do so. It was kind of interesting that the banks sought that as one of the primary things in their contract with the city, not to challenge the validity or authorization or of these agreements. So the first step is, of course, just is having somebody look at it, and the bankruptcy court is well situated to do that if it goes forward.
Well, the state-appointed emergency manager, Kevin Orr, was appointed by the governor, of course, who is a Republican. And my understanding is that there is a lot of partisan politics in this. You have a governor in a state that's, rural areas are Republican, urban areas, particularly Detroit, are Democrat. He's a very partisan governor. We've seen him act in very partisan ways. And Kevin Orr is a former corporate bankruptcy lawyer. What can you understand here? We talked about some of the deals that were made that have saddled the Detroit and seem to be the main cause for its bankruptcy, and yet so much of the coverage is about the pension debts that they have. But what about the politics? In other words, should this thing be happening in the first place? If you had a different governor and a different state appointed, well, let's start with a different governor.
Well, I advocated in my report, and of course I'm unconstrained by politics. I can advocate what I think is the appropriate way forward. I advocated in my report that the city really was suffering not from a spending problem. In other words, they had not spent their way through salary and benefits paid to employees into the circumstances they were in. The city had was devastated by the Great Recession. City's been in, had difficult structural problems economically for decades, but when the Great Recession hit, it was really injured badly. The reports say that roughly 73% of the mortgages in the city were subprime, for instance, and the city's unemployment rate shot up to 30%, close to 30%. So the way to move forward in my view, would be to have enhanced the city's revenues at least for a short period of time to get it structurally sound from the state, and that would be good for the state and by far the most economical way forward. But that's not the way the state proceeded. They proceeded with this emergency manager law, which took over the city and put them in a position to change the way the city operates over a longer term, from the state down, as opposed from the people of the city of Detroit deciding how to do those things.
So you mentioned how the city of Detroit, you mentioned how that the state could have actually lent the city money, but instead decided to appoint this emergency manager and take it into bankruptcy. And that the reason that the city was suffering was largely because of the recession, the 2008 recession. But weren't all these complicated Wall Street loans that the city took out with these swaps, etc., weren't they done on the eve of the 2008 recession?
Yes, the complicated financings took place, and it was about $1.5 billion worth of financing. What they did was they borrowed that money and actually deposited it into the pension funds to build up the funding in the pension funds. So those complicated financings took place in 2005 and 2006. It wasn't the financings themselves that created the bankruptcy situation. The financings themselves were burdensome, but that wasn't as nearly as important as the fact that the city just lost its revenue base in a catastrophic way. However, once the city got into trouble, what happened is that the complexity of those financings came back to haunt them because they were on hair triggers to be the financings were on hair triggers to be terminated, and for the banks to ask for their money all at one time. In essence, they were asking for 25 years of interest on something like $800 million of debt, all to be paid on one day. That's probably the best way to think of it. So that's what happened was once they got on the ropes, and it looked bad for the city in terms of their cash position. The financings then kicked in, and the bank started asking for their money immediately. So now the question is, now that since they're in this circumstance, who gets paid? The banks, or the city services get funded, or do the pensioners get paid? So that's what the tension is now, is who gets paid. And the banks and the emergency manager have more or less said that, at least in large measure, it's going to be the banks through these derivatives. And we're saying that now you should resist paying the banks as much as you can and get to the bottom of this, and hopefully that money would then be available for city services and to pay pensioners, because the pensioners, if they get their benefits cut, it's just going to be a very, very harsh result for them.
Well, at this point, they're being offered 16 cents on the dollar, as opposed to the banks, they're getting between 75 and 82 cents on the dollar. And these pensions are what they average at about 19,000 a year, and 30,000 for the firefighters, who of course don't get Social Security.
That's right. So it's $19,000 a year for the on average for the ununiformed, and then police and fire is higher, of course. And these are all very reasonable and modest pensions. So if someone gets cut at that level by half or down to 16%, you're going to have more bankruptcies, of course, and it's going to be the people who had worked for years with the belief that they were putting money away and the city was putting money away for them, so they'd actually have a retirement where they could live and exist, and that's just not going to be the case if the pensions get cut severely at all.
But it does seem that there's some evidence that the banks that sold these swaps may have acted unethically, because in order to pay back this $1.5 billion into the underfunded pensions, the mayor and the city created these nonprofits, did they not? And issued the debt, and then they brought in these interest rate swaps as a hedge, and they basically doubled down. And it's worth reminding our audience that the mayor is in jail. And by the way, is the mayor in jail for taking some kind of kickbacks? Is that We know that the person who negotiated the loans for the city with the banks ended up working for the banks, right?
Last I checked, he was working for a small bank in Ohio that was part of the deal. That's the former finance director. Again, I don't know. I mean, what I'm saying is that should be, questioned. I mean, to make certain there was nothing untoward about that. And it is true that the mayor is serving time because of financial dealings with contractors. In fact, he was just recently ordered to pay $4.5 million of restitution to the city, although I'm sure that's not going to that's not likely to actually be paid at this point. But yeah, that all occurred. I think that the what's most telling is that nobody can answer the question, the following question. If you, let's say you were going to go get a mortgage, you could get a fixed rate mortgage or get a floating rate mortgage. The city did not want interest rate risk exposure. So, but instead of doing just 100% fixed rate debt, they did this large portion of their debt floating rate, and then went through the complex derivative transactions to synthetically create it, convert it to fixed rate. So the simple question is, why didn't you just do it the simple way? And nobody's been able to answer that question. I mean, the emergency manager and his advisors have been asked the question in depositions, and they say, we don't know and we haven't checked. But it stands to reason that oftentimes more complex financings are situations where the financial institutions can charge more money and can make more profit without it being apparent how they're doing it. Just because they're complex. That simple question has to be answered, sure. and they have to check to see if that's indeed what happened.
But it looks like didn't these casinos, these three casinos, weren't they sort of their $11 million monthly payments were used as collateral?
Well, that's a good question. You actually asked a question that has, I've discovered, has more legal ramifications than you would think. About 20% of the city's revenues come from taxes on wagering at casinos that are inside the city. And what happened was that, not in 2005 when the derivatives were done, but in 2009 there was after the financial meltdown, there was a situation where the banks claimed again in 2009. This is 4 years later, we're doing the same thing. But in 2009, the banks claimed that they could terminate and get all their money. In order to avoid the banks doing that, the city entered into an agreement in 2009, which purports to give the banks access for as security, to lien on these casino revenues. But one of the questions, of course, the court has to determine is whether that was whether that lien will be recognized in bankruptcy, and that's not a completely straightforward answer. And one of the questions that the court was asking over the last couple of days is, did the emergency manager, have you looked into this? What is your advice? Why are you just assuming that lien was validly granted? And there's been no answer forthcoming today.
Well, of course, the attorneys come from Kevin Orr's former law firm, and there just doesn't seem to be any real transparency in this kind of fire sale or this looting, if indeed that's what it is. But just to finish up here, because we only got a minute left, I asked you earlier about why isn't the U.S. attorney not moving in there? Don't you have a Democratic senator, don't you, there in Michigan?
Yeah, Carl Levin. Yes.
Carl Levin, a very senior guy, and he's one of the people in the Senate that seems to be a champion of the people. So is there any expectation somebody's going to step up here and save this city from this, what seems to be an unnecessary bankruptcy?
Well, I from time to time have been in contact with Senator Levin's office about some of these issues. I did a lot of work on the Dodd-Frank Act, financial reform generally. So Senator Levin was a key backer of that. So I am aware of and knowledgeable about his staff. The congressional delegation is watching this. I think they're likely to let the process move on. I think if the court really gets into these circumstances, I think that the bankruptcy court is able to do a lot of work to find out all the circumstances. So I think that's likely what's going to happen. I think that's the first step, and just find out exactly what the actual circumstances were is the first step, and I think the court has shown an interest in doing that, so I think they should proceed.
And that's encouraging, and I thank you very much for joining us, Wallace Turberville.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and the environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. And he's the author of the new report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and recording engineer Alan Barker. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.